Hi, everybody. This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. When you talk about big sounds, big action, big emotions, it usually comes from an instrument. And then from the instrument, it comes the player who brings their life and vitality through what they're playing, whether it's flutes, a flageolet, and in this case, a cello. We are super thrilled. We're excited beyond belief to invite Tina Guo, a master cellist, electronic impresario. You could say she's Hans Zimmer's left and right hand. She's just amazing. We're welcoming her to the show. I got to keep my excitement down because when I think of the music that she's capable of and what she does to stadiums and soundtracks and video games, it's just like mind blasting. So Tina, thank you for coming on the show. How are things in your world?
Wow, what an intro. I'm going to try to live up to your expectations. My gosh, things are good. It is Wednesday morning. It's, 12 days from Christmas. So everything is great.
Excellent. What's on your wish list? What would you love for Christmas?
My Christmas list? Okay, to be completely candid, to get pregnant. This is a new development that we are currently working on, which is good because, with like careers and work, I think for everybody, but obviously, especially if you're the woman who is responsible for, the physical aspect of this pregnancy situation, it is never the right time, and it's like analyzing every year, oh, I have to tour, I have to do this. But at some point you have to just, I think, bite the bullet and go for it. So that would be one. I'm excited for all these different projects happening next year. I already have contingency plans on, depending on if it works immediately or it takes a long time or whatever. So we're going to be touring Hans Zimmer Live next year. It hasn't been announced yet, but in North America and South America, that's a plan, as well as some dates in like Dubai, Asia, not Europe, because we've been doing Europe tours for the past few years. And then I have a new tribal project in the works. It's called The Water Phoenix, and it's my imagination of what my music would have sounded like if I was born in the prehistoric era. So in the Asian region of what is now, I guess, kind of China, because my ethnic background is mostly Chinese, a little bit of Mongolian, Japanese, Korean, and a tiny bit of Pakistani, actually, according to my DNA profile. So I thought that was really interesting. And then I'm also working on a couple of, the usual, oh, we can't talk about it yet, but a game engine related thing, providing music for that. And then some other projects with a collaborator, a longtime friend of mine who also works with Hans, Steve Mazzaro. We have a new software, music software company that we're launching next year. My wish is that all of these things go smoothly and I'm able to balance everything without losing my mind.
There's so much to unpack there, from hoping for pregnancy and going live and then doing passion projects. Okay, so basically when this child is born, they will be strapped to your back and on the whirlwind of their life.
Well, I talked to a friend who is a composer, a music director who lives in Italy yesterday about actually another project I am not going to mention until it actually manifests into reality, but very exciting. And he and his wife just had a son, 2 months old, and he was telling me how he was literally conducting an orchestra at the Vatican, where the Pope is, for a concert, 75-piece orchestra, during the rehearsals with his baby strapped to his chest. So, it can be done.
That's so good to hear. At a very early age, you were put through the ringer musically. So you were asked to perform or practice 8 hours a day, and it seems like your life has not slowed down since. Let's go back to the very beginning. You learning to play piano, taking on cello, and gradually getting to USC. Let's take us through some of those paces, if you don't mind.
Sure. So I was born in Shanghai, China, in the year 1985, authentic made in China person. My parents are both classical musicians. They met actually when they were in the Red Army, the Communist Army, because everybody was required to be in the army at that time, in the orchestra, which was a really good gig because that was safer than, being, I guess, on the front line or some of the other things. It was either at that time when they were growing up, I just think this is so fascinating because I didn't know too much about, the communist era previously. But they either you had to be in the military, or they would send you off to the farms in the northern China area to be a rice farmer, and you had to serve basically for a year. And a lot of the time, what would happen with people would be stuck there. So you would literally become like a farmer for the rest of your life, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but if that's not your life goals, that was to be avoided, right? So anyway, they met in the orchestra. My dad was the first chair cellist. My mom was in, he, my dad jokes, she was in the back of the second violin section, but he still found her interesting and alluring. So they met there, and when I was, I think, 6 months old, actually, so right after I was born, it was not a planned pregnancy. They had gotten an opportunity to move to America, and this was during the Clinton era when they had like a special policy for specifically Chinese students to be able to immigrate to the U.S., which is great because it was just when China, U.S. relations were opening at that time, post-communist era. So they came out to the U.S. to study in Connecticut at the Hart School of Music, both of them. So they left me with my grandparents, my mom's parents, who lived in Shanghai, and got a old, piano set up. So they said, okay, when she turns three, have her start playing the piano, because they didn't know when I'd be able to, join them because they were in school. So I started piano lessons. I don't really remember much of it. And then at five and a half, I moved out to the US to join my parents. And that's when I started playing the violin, which was terrible. I think I played for about 6 months or something, 6 months, and I couldn't even get past Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. So that was very tragic. And they said, oh my God, she has no talent. This is terrible. But then I switched over to the cello, and that went a lot more smoothly. So I think, like, definitely, if you practice something for thousands of hours, you'll get good at it. But I do think everybody has a slight propensity towards certain things that come more naturally to them. So I guess for me, that just happened to be the cello. But I was not one of those, child prodigy kids that wanted to practice, that would wake up at 5 in the morning and wanted to. I was forced to practice. So this was actually not a choice I made for myself. It was like being bred, very, very Chinese, Chinese, Russian, old school style to be a musician. And I think for my parents, it's because it truly was not the only skill set, but basically the only monetizable skill set that they had, because that's what they were able to do. So for them, I think really, pushing super hard, which is, this is not an uncommon story again, I think, with a lot of Asian cultures. But I was forced by many different kinds of methods to practice for 8 hours a day, a minimum 8 hours a day on top of normal school from the time I started until I was 18. And growing up, I don't know, like all my entire childhood, I didn't have much of one. It was more of just, it was like a boot camp, right? To study, practice, do all the competitions, do all the, music theory lessons and all that stuff. And I think at the time it really wasn't so enjoyable. However, in retrospect, I'm definitely grateful for it because without all those hours of practice, it would make what I do now so, like, really actually impossible, because I think underneath all of like whatever image you have, photo shoots, video shoots, performing, whatever, stage presence, all business acumen, all of that aside, on the very, very base foundational level, if you suck, it's not going to go very far, right? So like the actual end product needs to have some type of I think like a solid foundation. So whether I liked it or not, that's what I was bred to do. And then for college, I was very lucky to get a full tuition scholarship for USC, the University of Southern California, Thornton School of Music. And I studied with Eleanor Schoenfeld. Her and her sister were legends, right, in the pedagogy world of classical music. And they were actually the ones that discovered my father back in China in 1980. I think I was born in 85, so 1986. They started, as soon as things started opening, they would go back to China at the time, I think every year, and look for talented, students who wanted an opportunity to get out of China. And so she and her sisters were actually the ones that sponsored my family out. So I ended up studying with her. She was already in her 80s, but amazing lady. My God, she was like, I don't think they were stilettos, but they were literally like 2-inch tall heels. She's 80, I think 80. 3 or 84 at the time. Beautiful. Everything was just, I mean, obviously an amazing teacher and an amazing cellist, but on top of that, I was just really inspired by how, I don't know, how like everything, the full package, really, really cool. So, I studied there with her, and when I got to college was when I started experimenting with other types of music. I had heard previous to that a little bit of like industrial metal music, which really, really resonated with me. I think just from all the, angst and frustration of of my childhood, namely Marilyn Manson. I did hear Apocalyptica, the cello metal band, which I thought was really cool, and that was the first time I had heard of that concept. I wasn't familiar with the music, which was Metallica. It was their first album. Apocalyptica plays Metallica, but I just thought, oh, that's cool. That's something different. But I didn't have any access to the internet previous to this, even though the internet, was invented. Those AOL CDs were being shipped around, I think, when I was in middle school. But my parents were, again, super strict, so I had almost no access to that. But when I got to college, and got my first Acer laptop, which is a gift from my uncle, a terrible computer, but at least I could access Facebook, which had just come out. We were in one of the first test groups, because it was a college networking tool at the time, Facebook, and then YouTube. So that's when I started watching videos of guitar players, because I really thought that was cool. And I thought, like, God, I wish I play the electric guitar. I wish I could make all these different sounds. And then I realized that they made this thing called the electric cello, and even Apocalyptica, they still didn't use electric instruments. They were acoustic instruments that were processed. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe if I play the electric cello, that's kind of similar to electric guitar. I can make some of these sounds, and I can use, the cello technical skill that I already have, to do that. So that's when I started experimenting. Sorry, that was a very long-winded story. I was trying to make it as, I mean, I left out 99% of details, but as concise as possible.
And we thank you for that. We thank you for that.
Okay.
The exciting thing about learning any instrument is that it's kind of like a rabbit hole. You don't really know how deep it can go. You mentioned YouTube, you mentioned Facebook, and even USC. So who were some of the people that you got to know, either through internet groups or on campus, who helped widen your exposure and your experience?
Let me see. So I think the most monumental musical, maybe mind expansion for me happened in seventh grade at Mesa Verde Middle School in San Diego. And there was this kid. I was always attracted to people, things that were dark and weird and unique, right? Again, just the, I think, rebellion, the usual stuff, whatever. And so this kid, his name was Luke. He had wore black lipstick every day. He had long hair. I mean, he's in seventh grade, so how goth can you be? But he was a, seventh grader who's as goth as you could possibly be at that time, who wore these huge, like, nerdy glasses, right? So a nerd goth combo. And I just found him fascinating because there's not very many other people like that. Most of the people at the school and the community were very not conservative, but like preppy, right? So one day at lunch, he handed me a CD, and he's like, "Oh, you should listen to this." And I'm like, "What is this?" He's like, "It's Marilyn Manson, and Antichrist Superstar." Aside from all of the, personal issues that this gentleman's been having recently, just purely speaking from like an artistic musical perspective, I had never heard industrial metal before. And the first time that I heard it, I brought it home, played it on my boom box that I had with only one working speaker, right? I think it was the right side wasn't working, so it just left audio, and I turned it all the way down so you could barely hear it, because if my parents heard this, like me listening to this, I don't know, demonic music or whatever it was, they would have been very upset, and I would not be here speaking with you today because I would be dead, right? So, and I heard it. I remember hearing the beautiful people for the first time, and there was just something that was very visceral. And I think I always, I mean, maybe like kids when they're younger, they don't really are aware of the concept of like being visceral. But I think, I don't know, for some reason, I just felt like a physical reaction to it. And that type of reaction that I feel towards certain things, especially like, you know, music that I'm passionate about, it's like it's a physical feeling in my lower abdominal region. And I felt that for the first time, right? So I think that was the biggest thing. And so, of course, once I had access to the internet and other types of music, I listened to a lot of Marilyn Manson and whatever music videos were being put up, you know. And but as far as like other people that I met, I wouldn't actually say that anyone at USC in particular had much of an effect, like creatively. It was definitely Professor Schoenfeld, I think, because I studied only classical cello at the time. And for my first, I dropped out of school, by the way, after 2.5 years because things got busy and I was performing. But previous to that, when I was performing at that time, it wasn't on electric cello. I was actually playing like classical concertos. So I was leaving school for maybe like a few weeks to sometimes a month and a half at a time to play with some never A-level orchestras, but, you know, BC-level orchestras, just gigging, right? So because I had to make money to pay for food and my dorm because the scholarship only covered tuition. But she was very, very open. Unlike my other professors, I have to say, they were not cool with like the other stuff I was experimenting with. I remember in Baroque music class, I think the teacher gave me an F because, and I'm not, you know, music is such a subject thing. I mean, I don't know. It's like, it's really about personal taste. But my teacher at the time, not saying it was wrong or right, but she insisted that everybody play Bach the exact same way. So because I played it in a slightly more maybe like romantic way, which again, looking back, it was probably a little extreme, a little over the top, but if you're not over the top when you're young, what's going to happen to you as you age? My God, you know, you like turn into like a, I don't know what, like nothing, you know. But she was, you know, again, not supportive of that. Most of the people there, they're like, oh, you're wasting your potential talent. You know, you could even maybe be a classical soloist, you know, in the, like grow that career a little bit. But and it's not that I don't have anything against classical music. I mean, I just played a concerto with the orchestra earlier, like maybe a couple months ago, and I still do that a little bit. But I don't know. I think I was just more interested in trying to use this thing that I was able to do, that was not my choice, to try to figure out how I could use this tool, which was my only skill set, not the only one, but you know, the only skill set that was like developed at that time, to make money, you know, to make a living, to build some kind of career, and explore my fascination with the dark side. So, and yeah, so I think the fact that Eleanor was so open, which is incredible because she's, you know, 85 years old or something, and she didn't really understand my love for metal or industrial music. And I remember when we would do like group master classes or recitals, she would always say to me, oh, with her very heavy German accent, which I can't emulate, but she would say something like, oh, dearie, why don't you show us all some of your jazz music? Like, to her, jazz was like the most wild thing you can imagine, right? And I didn't want to correct her. Yeah, living on the edge. And I don't know. I don't think did I ever play? No, I didn't play because I'm like, oh, it's totally different. It doesn't make any sense to play, like try to play metal on a classical cello. It's a completely different thing. You know, it's like a classical guitar versus an electric guitar. Any classical guitarist could technically pick up an electric guitar and know where the notes are, but it's not even about the technical aspect. It's about, I don't know, what do you call it, the balls? Not to say classical musicians don't have balls. I'm just saying it's a different approach. I think it's a completely different, to me, a different animalistic primal approach versus European art music that's more refined and you know, stylized, which is also equally beautiful, but I think in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's Paco Flocka or Gustavo Santaolalla, and then there's Slash and Joe Perry. I mean, these guys are completely different animals, iguanas, creatures, so to speak. But I think that what's in them comes out in the instrument they choose. So more to your point, I mean, I think the one of the most astonishing things about watching you perform is that how you, I don't know if transform is the right word for it, but, you know, there's a reason why Hans puts you center stage and you just become this, I'm going to say peacock, but like peacocks are useless. Like you actually have a purpose and you drive the symphony, you drive the stadium. So like, what do you have to do and what do you channel into your performance and your cello when you're on stage and you are just commanding an auditorium?
Thank you. Like the word channel is definitely the term that I use. What is it that I channel? I think it's just pure, first of all, being in the moment, right? So I think in our day-to-day lives, in my day-to-day life, so much of my work, career, it's, yes, it's music, but I would sometimes say it's like 60% business, right? Because I manage everything myself. I'm running my own websites, merchandise stores, I code everything. Like it's a whole, you know, contract negotiations. And so I'm not that I'm not in the moment, but like, there's a lot of thinking all the time, you know, monkey mind, like a lot of us. But for me, when I'm performing, that's the only time, if I can really get into like the flow, that's the only time that I'm free from any type of thinking. I'm completely in the moment. People reach that, you know, with runner's high, with meditation. For me, it's through the cello, through performing. If I've practiced enough and I'm not thinking like, oh shit, what's next? I can't remember, right? So the flow state can only be reached with enough practice. That's my point. But when I'm in that state, I am channeling, it's just pure emotion. And I think because I'm just naturally a very emotional person. I just feel everything to an extreme. I think everybody has really, really intense feelings, but people express it differently. I'm very expressive. I don't know why. It's just how, you know, how I was born, much to my parents' dismay, because they did not like that, right? For me, I'm just expressing what I feel. So I think I'm a big proponent of like people experiencing, especially people who come from a very conservative classical background like me, to go out and open their minds to different experiences and ways of thinking and people and music and emotions and have like wild love affairs and do you know, whatever, as crazy as you want to go. But I just, so people know, I don't do drugs and I don't drink. I've actually never been drunk. So for me, all of my exploration is purely, I don't want to sound frou-frou, but it's like purely spiritual, not like pertaining to any religion in particular, but like spiritual / like human experience based, right? So I think the more that you feel physically, the more that you feel like emotionally, the more that you're able to channel, because if you don't feel those things, a performance can come off as fake, because it is fake, because you're like, because maybe you're like, oh, like I saw this person make this movement. I saw this person do this. And like, that's what I'm going to do. But there's something about, it's not even what you're doing. It's like where it comes from. You can feel the energy, right? And I think for me, like what I'm channeling is just what I've experienced, you know, in like life-wise. And definitely growing up in a situation that was super extreme. You know, I don't want to give too many details, but just imagine, I don't know, imagine what old school people do to, you know, to force their kids to do stuff, right, for 8 hours a day. And the type of like angst and frustration and anger, actually, I think that was a good starter, fuel to like kind of expand my, I think, emotional, you know what I'm trying to say? To expand your like emotional experience from like a very young age, because most kids are not, maybe they don't experience that, right? Like there wasn't a lot of happiness, I have to say, which I've made up for, I think, later in life as I've like worked through stuff and experienced more positive things. But I think having that, and then again, like in my, if you want to call it, like you said, like the stage persona or Jekyll Hyde or whatever, in real life, in day-to-day life, like this is me. I feel like I'm pretty happy, actually, overall. I'm happy. I'm, you know, very focused on, music, but also financial gain. You know, I'm really big into that and all of that stuff. But I think I think musically, that's like, I don't know, I'm just able to channel some other like deeper things. So that's, hopefully that makes some sense.
No, I think that's fantastic. I think because there everybody needs an outlet. I think
Right.
that's an understatement. And whether it
Yeah.
is hitting golf balls or sitting and doing goat yoga or something, everybody needs to channel something. So you found something that is converse to the sort of forced nature of playing to the point where you can more freely let it out, even to the to the point you're doing this Primal Phoenix project, which sounds amazing. What I'm really excited to talk to you about is this is one of the discs from the Hans Zimmer Live 4XLP. And I wanted to read two quotes on here so I don't get it incorrectly. And you say, "I feel a lot more powerful. It feels like a weapon in my hands. Only when performing live is when I can enter the flow state. It's a loop of energy and everything is frozen in time." It's beautiful. Because not
Thank
only is it
you.
frozen, it's like you've galvanized. Things are galvanized to the point where it's that lower abdomen singing that you were talking about.
Yeah. No, everything is 100% primal, visceral. There's no mind at all, right? And that, again, that only happens with enough preparation, which is purely in the mind. So it's actually like the complete opposite. So only when you've analyzed and practiced everything like a gazillion times, 10,000 times, can you, when you're performing, can you not have to think anymore, right? It's all muscle memory. It's all embedded, and then you're able to fully channel whatever it is. I think different people have different terms for it. Higher power, people like to say universal energy. Like for me, I do feel energy, and usually it's the more people, the better, right? Because more people equals more energy. And it's not like an ego thing where, oh, there's people watching me. It's not that. It's literally, I feel like the their cells or something. It's like the energy. And I think the unique thing about performing is that in that moment, it's not just for me, it's everyone else on stage, everyone in the audience. We're all single pointedly focused on one thing. And like that type of like energy creation, I mean, it's pretty amazing, you know?
Well, you talk about life-changing experiences. I would say that in 2021, there was a life-changing experience. I heard the score to Army of Thieves. And as soon as that came out, I was like, I've got to speak to whoever worked on this. So I got in touch with Steve Mazzaro, and we talked about Bond, we talked about Doom, we talked about you, we talked about Hans. And I love that score so much, and you're featured prominently on it as a cellist. So when it is live performance versus, I would say, session playing is more of a controlled live performance, is there a different approach? How is that process? What is your thought process those days?
It is very different. It's a different, like the emotions are still there, of course, but it's a lot more controlled because the focus is not on me channeling whatever, it's on the project, right? We're serving a bigger, I don't want to say a bigger deity. I mean, I don't know, that's a little dramatic, but everyone's serving the picture or the project. So working, I mean, I've worked with Steve on so many different things. And like I mentioned earlier, we're starting a new company together, which we're launching next year. And so it's always wonderful to work with him. I think with Army of Thieves, I did that remotely. Yes, remotely. Most of the stuff I've done is remote, including Dune and Top Gun and all of that during COVID, which is an adventure. And yeah, like it depends on the composer or the client, because I work a lot of different ways with different people. But for that one, Steve already wrote all the cello parts, and so they just send me, session files, MIDI stems, whatever, because I work in Logic, and they're in Cubase. So I just get the files, and then I record myself. I usually give I give clients, like, I always say, deliver more, right, than you're expected to, because that's the only way to I think keep and maintain like a brand and to grow it. So like, never just do enough, because enough is fine, but enough is average, right? So I try to give at least like three different variations, like perfect takes that are fully edited already. So I do all of that myself, and then with, like, I don't know, different articulations or variations, and then I just send it back to them, and then that's it. So it's really most of the time I don't even see picture. You know, there's no brief. But for me, it's more of just listening to the music. Like once I hear the backing track, once I hear maybe like the synth hello, which a lot of times is the robot version of me. It's my sample library. It's just funny. And then, yeah, I just listen to it and see like how I feel or whatever. And then I don't know, I record it. So I guess it's not mechanical, but that's much more of a, I think a, there's like a very clear process to that, you know?
Well, talk about never meeting your heroes, because you pulled back the curtain on the whole musical process. I thought you floated in on a carriage made of doves, and was like, here is featured celloist, soloist, Tina Guo. Okay, well, that's now I know more about the process. It's like, I guess it's voice acting, like voiceovers. They sit in a booth, they don't talk to anybody, and they just use the audio, they use the take and put it in the mix. So, okay. Well, great. You've got a couple posters behind you. Hancock, I believe that's John Powell's score. And is that Dunkirk under it?
No. Oh, actually, like my more favorite ones are actually on this wall. But
Okay.
no, they're just some of the projects I've worked on. Like Hancock, Battle LA, Predators. But on this wall, which you can't see, we've got
Okay.
Dune, Batman versus Superman, the new Top Gun movie, Wonder Woman, of course, Inception, Dunkirk, Iron Man 2, John Debney, or Sherlock Holmes, the first project I ever worked with Hans on,
Wow,
Gemini
okay.
Man. Lauren Balfe and Shazam. That was one of the newer ones. And then I did work with Brian on, was it one of the Fast and Furious? I don't remember what it was, but
Well, he did Battle LA, I think Brian did.
oh, that one too. Yes. But that was in the orchestra. That was when I was playing in like the session orchestras. But we did
Okay.
something on the electric cello, and I cannot remember for the life of me what it was. But it was around the same time as Sherlock Holmes.
Okay. Well, talk about a game. Well, I would say Inception and Sherlock Holmes are kind of game-changing scores for the film community. What kind of brief did you get on either of those? I mean, I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot to say, go back to 2009 and
No.
but.
I remember. I remember. I remember very clearly because. So what happened was, okay, I'm gonna make this concise. I talk too much. Sorry. Okay. So I was trying to do this electric cello thing, trying being the keyword. It was not very successful, right? So after I dropped out of USC, because I started gigging, I was doing some of those classical concerts, and even though, like I mentioned, I would be gone for 3 weeks to like a month and a half at a time, they didn't pay very much. I mean, it paid terribly, right? So it just wasn't enough for even paying for my books and my dorm. So that was a problem. So I'm like, okay, I also need to learn how to play different styles of music on the electric cello. So I started gigging. Like, I played at every bar, every club on the Sunset Strip. Some of those clubs have been closed already now, sadly, but for like $50 or something. Yeah, not including the parking. So at the end of the day, I had like nothing, right? But with all cut anyone who would pay. So I would advertise on Craigslist every single day. I would post like multiple ads. You're not supposed to do that because it's like spamming. I would change like the wording, change stuff to try to just get work. And so in the beginning of my career, the majority of my work came from Craigslist, you know? And so I was doing this for 3 years, I think 3 years. A couple years after I left school, and I was living in a garage in Sun Valley. It wasn't even a full garage. It was half of a garage. The landlord's car was parked in the other half. There's like this weird like plastic like partition wall. I did go all the way across, but yeah, I mean there was no heating, no air conditioning. There was a bathroom, the kitchen, there was no stove, so I just got like a one of those hot plates from Target, Target. And then what did I have in there? And like a mini fridge from Craigslist, and a small microwave from Craigslist, all used, right? Except for the Target hot plate. That was like my big splurge. 20, I remember it was like 20, $23 plus tax. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm spending $23 so I can cook. But I was living in that garage for I think almost 2 years. And yeah, I mean it was pretty shitty, right? So I thought, okay, maybe I'm completely delusional. My parents definitely thought I was delusional. A lot of people did. Maybe I should just, get like try to get a good orchestra job because at least I'll have a steady income. I'll have, health insurance and benefits. And the San Diego Symphony actually just had an opening for a section cello player. And my parents were, because they live in San Diego, oh my God, you should audition. And I was like, okay, yeah, maybe I'm just insane. This is because I had done a couple of like smaller, what had I done at that point? I mean, I hadn't met Hans. I think I had started working with, oh, my friend Austin Wintry, who went to USC at the same time. And this was in the very early stages of his career as well. And Journey was something because it took a really long time to come out, like years. And so we had, I think, started experimenting a little bit with that. But other than that, I had not worked on any soundtrack projects. Like that wasn't even my focus. I wanted to be a metal electric cello player, and tour with Rammstein or Metallica or whatever, delusional ideas I had at the time. But again, it wasn't working. So I started preparing to audition for the San Diego Symphony. I was practicing all the repertoire. And I thought to myself, God, like before I give up, on my crazy little dream, I need to do something to at least have like some type of remnant so I can show my grandkids one day or just to have it, right? If I'm really going to just give up and again, there's nothing wrong with being in an orchestra, but just for me personally, that was like giving up on my own creative pursuits, right? So I was like, okay, well, I'm always telling people, yeah, I want to be a heavy metal electric cello player. And they're like, okay, cool. Like nobody cares what you, well, first of all, nobody cares. But second of all, no one can picture what, like any idea, ideas are cheap. Everybody has ideas. Everybody has musical ideas, business ideas. It doesn't matter, right? As long as it's just an idea, it has to become concrete. So I thought, oh, well, I watch these YouTube videos. Maybe I should like, that's it. I'll make a music video. And I have to create the track. Like, what can I do? And at the time, I hadn't. I think musically, I hadn't expanded as much yet. So for me, I thought, well, I could play the Flight of the Bumblebee. That's really fast, right? That's a classical piece I already know. And people, in the rock fusion world, like they're always impressed by shredding capabilities. The ability to play really, really fast. So I'm like, okay, I can do that. So that might be cool. Metal people might think it's cool. So I made an arrangement of the Flight of the Bumblebee called Queen Bee. And so my idea was that, okay, it's going to be artistic representation of like me as like a bee in a hive. And originally that video, I mean, again, crazy, but yeah, I think big, right? I'm like, okay, I want to have 100 male extras, and I want them to be gold, like covered in body paint, naked, because bees don't wear clothing. And then I realized, you know what? Probably most straight males like wouldn't want to be in that type of situation. So now I have to find 100. Okay, so and then yeah, I had to put a band together because I got everything recorded, and I hired some friends who like to record the guitar, drums, and bass parts. Myself on the electric cello, but anyway, my entire budget was very, very low. It was like the last I spent at the time. I mean, it was still a lot of money. It's like almost $5,000 or $6,000 all in, and that was everything I had saved from all of my gigs. Plus, keep in mind, I was in a lot of debt too at the time, a credit card debt, all the other stuff from school, for living expenses. And so I was like, whatever, I'll figure it out. I'm going to spend every penny I have left on this thing, and I was very lucky to meet an incredible director, Rich Ragsdale. He also makes horror films, right? And he also writes music. So he has, and he was interested in just like basically he made nothing. I mean, it was just every penny that I had we spent towards the production, because he was interested, I think, artistically in the project. He pulled a lot of favors. We shot this video. I put it up on YouTube. Sorry. Too many details. Okay, I put it up on YouTube. The year was 2009. And did any metal people see this video or care? No, nobody cared. However, Hans Zimmer, Brian Tyler, John Debney, so like a bunch of film incredible soundtrack composers, heard, saw the video, and asked me if I wanted to, work on their soundtrack. So I think it was within like 2 or 3 days, Hans, Brian, and John, none of whom I knew. I had no idea who they were, you know, because I wasn't trying to do soundtrack music. They all reached out to me. And so with Hans, when his assistant called, I was like, who, you know, who is this? How did you get my number? Like, you don't know who Hans Zimmer is? I'm like, no. And he's like, no, no. And he's like, well, you know, we have a project. He saw your video. He writes music for, you know, films and stuff. Would you be interested in coming in? And I'm like, oh, okay, you know. So I went in, and what did they tell me at the front desk? Oh yeah, he's in like the back building talking to the director. They're having lunch. Why don't you go meet them there? So I go into the back building, and when I walked in, I did recognize Guy Ritchie, right? I'm like, oh, okay, Hans must be like a big deal. Like, I don't, you know, we'll see. I don't know what they're working on. So he sat down, I sat down, and Hans was just, I don't know, it just felt very, I mean, he's amazing. You know, I think he makes anybody feel comfortable, but I just felt super comfortable right off the bat. We had lunch. We didn't talk about the project at all. It was more just talking. I think Guy had just gotten divorced from Madonna. So he was complaining about her the whole time. So we were just, you know, talking about that stuff. And then after, at the time I was still smoking, he was also still smoking cigarettes. So he's like, oh, let's go up on the, you know, the patio and have a cigarette and, you know, talk work, right? So we went out there. He's like, oh yeah, so we're doing this Sherlock Holmes, you know, movie. Do you want to work on it? I'm like, yeah, of course. Sure, let's do it. He's like, okay, well, I want you to watch. I think it was nearly finished, but watch this current version of the movie. And then, I remember he was like, okay, well, how much do you charge? And that was like, it was so direct, you know? And at the time I'm like, I don't know. I just like threw out some, you know, random number, and he's like, oh, okay. And so with Sherlock Holmes, I watched the movie, and then I came back, I think for a full week after that, and recording a lot of layers of acoustic cello, not electric. But he said he wanted me to play the acoustic in, you know, it's like a kind of gypsy style, very aggressive style of acoustic cello playing. And that was the first time that I worked with Hans. And I can't even remember what your initial question was, but somehow I got here.
No, it was definitely Sherlock Holmes, but also Inception. But I think that, you know, that there's such a charm to that aggressive gypsy, not ephemera, but the way that soundtrack comes across, it's so unique, and it wasn't overdone, and even to this day it hasn't been overdone. So I think that's just a perfect moment in time that captured both the luck, the kismet that you two came together. And yeah, and I know Brian Tyler and I know John Debney through all of my interviews, but and I've spoken to literally everyone else who's worked with Hans but Hans. So you're like getting me closer to the precipice of, oh, what's it like in remote control? No, but that's amazing. And I think that's remarkable, because you not only, you went in all in, you believed in yourself, you know, I don't gamble, because I know that it'd be like throwing quarters in the toilet. I'd never see him again, but it's tremendous that this manifested. But without doing the research myself, tell me that this video is still out there.
It is still out there. It is rated 18 and over, which okay. I think is ridiculous, because it is not inappropriate in any way. It's just, it's artistic. And so you remember what I said about all the male extras? Well, there was nothing in the budget for that, so we had no male extras. But in the middle scene, in like the breakdown, I am coming out of a giant beehive that we made out of paper mache. I'm nearly naked, right? But I have gold nipple plates on. I'm covered in gold body paint, so there's nothing showing. But I think that was flagged. But I don't know. I love that video. It's really, and my friends who appeared in the video, actually the guitar player doesn't even play guitar, he's a model. But I think it no, it was a lot of fun, and I'm really grateful always to Johnny Coffin of Coffin Case. Like, you know, they make those coffin shaped guitar cases. If you look carefully in the back, we're actually in the warehouse. You see a bunch of boxes. That's why there's a forklift, because he's like, well, oh, you can shoot it, you know, in my factory for free, you know, because I was trying to like pull favors and whatnot. And that was such a monumental effort of a lot of, I think, endorsers and friends helping out. You know, I have friends bringing like bagels and like snacks for you know, the crew. It was a small crew. And then Yamaha provided, because I played the Yamaha electric cellos, and they provided the drums, like for the drummer to use, who was an yes, a real drummer, but different than the actual drummer who recorded on the song, because I think he was on tour or something. He's touring with Alice Cooper now, Glenn Sobel. And then, yeah, so that was, it was really, really fun. And I think also for me, going back to childhood, like I never, okay, so I loved Halloween. And my parents, I think partially because, you know, we're super poor, but also because, you know, we're very, also very conservative fiscally, which is separate from the fact that we were poor, because you could just buy things on credit cards, but we never did that. I never had any cool Halloween costumes. The only thing that I had, like a witch's hat that we got at a garage sale, and this like black sheet that I tied around me, like a cape. It doesn't even make any sense. I'm like a witch's hat and a cape, right? And that was my costume every year. And I would see all these other kids with their cool costumes, like, fuck. Sorry, I don't know if I can say the F word, but man, I'm like, I wish I could like look cool and do that, right? And so that type, that like desire and need, because I love like make believe or playing dress up. Like I never had any Barbies. I never had, like, they just wouldn't let me do anything because it was like, no, you have to work. This is, you're working. You know, there's nothing, there's no type of like creative outlets. And for me, cello at the time was not a creative outlet. It was like a technical, thing. I'm a machine, you know, learning how to play repertoire, classical repertoire. And I think in the making of that video, that's why I had all these crazy, weird ideas, or like costumes and like different places. And I'm still like that, right? Just like, how far can we push it? How far can I play dress up? Because I'm a kid. I'm like still trying to play dress up, just getting all that pent up energy out. And I think in the creation of that video, like I really just, I do love how it turned out. It's very dark, you know, it's like very goth, but I think once I made the video, and I was still preparing to audition for the San Diego Symphony, and it wasn't, it actually, I don't know if it was really, maybe it was kind of gambling, but this was only a calculated gamble after I already decided to give up and I was going to audition for, you know, and look for other sources of income that were more traditional and, you know, whatever. But yeah, I mean, it did pay off, not in the way that I wanted it to. I mean, I think it turned out even better, but it just, I guess you have to be open to the things, the curveballs that life throws at you. Because through film music, I've been able to play metal, you know, like the Wonder Woman theme that I wrote with Hans, like that's very, very metal. And I think when we did that, and I made a music video for that, and I thought, oh my God, like it actually did work out, you know, except it just took like a weird, a different path to that. And then during all of this time, I also ran away with the circus, with the Cirque du Soleil for 2 years from 2011 to 2013. So this was after Inception. I did that on the electric cello also because they saw that music video. It was the Michael Jackson, the Immortal World Tour. So half owned by the Jackson Estate, half owned by Cirque du Soleil. This was after Michael passed. So they never did the This Is It tour. And because he wasn't there, they were like, okay, we have to have some other elements. There's like a mini version of that show in Vegas. It's like a resident show, taking like some of the equipment and stuff and some of the people that were in that show. And they have an incredible show in Vegas that's running, you know, all the time. But that tour, that was also the manifestation of like me wanting to play electric cello like a guitar player in arenas, you know? And I told that to a couple people like back in the day. Oh, like, what are you trying to do with this thing? I'm like, I want to be like Slash. Like you said, Slash, literally. I said, I want to be like Slash. And they're like, okay, whatever. You know, like crazy. And I remember opening night Montreal, right? After 3 months of rehearsals, because I was playing the guitar parts. So like a Beat It, like there was also a guitar player, but they had the electric cello, something weird. I don't know, that the Cirque people saw. And so we would trade off. It was like a electric cello, electric guitar battle and Beat It and a bunch of other numbers. I also had a solo number of music I wrote myself. And I remember on opening night, like I'd never played in a venue that big, right? In an arena. And I like looked out from the side of the stage and it was completely full. Gulp. Oh my God. Like so it was amazing. And I did 360 shows in a row over 2 years with Cirque. And that was responsible. I think that was hugely responsible for how I perform on the electric cello, because yes, like I feel like I was already pretty expressive, but everything in Cirque du Soleil, big, bigger, bigger, bigger. And when you're around and your mind is open to not musicians, you know, but the way that acrobats, dancers, aerialists, whatever, pole dancers, and like the world champion pole dancer was in that show. and how they project and their energy. I mean, it's like a ball of like fire. Like you can feel them when they walk into a room, right? And when they perform. And I think being around that was incredible for kind of permeating me with like how, oh, like this is how you perform. This is how you project to an audience. So yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, I think with that amount of experience, you know, actually Brian Tyler likes to use the expression embarrassment of riches. But like if I had that to my credit, I don't think I'd be able to look at the future. I think I would just be so in awe of the things that I've done as I am in awe of the things that you've done. We're about out of time. I do think that this we need to do a part two, maybe talk about you and Steve together with your company. But man, this has been so much fun, Tina. I think that they should change the names of the strings on the cello to T-I-N-A. It should be. Yeah, that's how much command you have over the musical world.
Oh, you're very kind. Thank you so much. It's been fun. I'm sorry I talked too much. I just go on and on and on, but it's been fun chatting with you. And yes, absolutely, it'd be great. I'm going to see Steve on Friday, so maybe we can do another chat together.
Okay, fantastic. Well, hey, thank you again for your time. Everybody, check out Tina's work in video games, concert halls, movies, stage. I'm pretty sure she's going to do like a, maybe she has a puppet show planned. I would love to see a hardcore
puppet show. I just started baking artisan bread, so.
There is no stopping you. Well, Ms. Guo, we will catch you next time, but thank you so much. And everyone, have a Merry Christmas.